Good morning, everyone, all the listeners out there. I want to share a little bit about who I am. I'm Derek McDowell. You may know me from the community as the founder of the Youngstown FLEA, as well as the community engagement and inclusion coordinator with the new Youngstown Foundation Amphitheater. Enough about me. I'd like to share that I'm here with a woman whom I love for who she is, and that is the Honorable Judge Renee DeSalvo. I'd like to just welcome her this morning.
Good morning, Derek.
Good morning. Thank you for being here with me.
Thank you for being with me.
It's an honor and a pleasure. So I know, and often the world that we live in, we sort of like to jump right in when we have these types of conversations. So do you mind if we do just that?
Nope, it's absolutely fine.
All right. So for as much as I love you, I want to be selfless in this moment and share you with others. So I just want to give you an opportunity. I know there are times where we will read up and research all about who we are, and a person can try and know you. I want you to tell the listeners for themselves who you are.
Let me just give a little bit of background about my life and where I've come from, my roots. We are all the sum total of the experiences that we've had in our life. Who am I? Well, I was raised Catholic on the south side of Youngstown. I went to St. Dominic's School. I had wonderful parents. My grandparents were Italian immigrants, very self-sustaining, raised in a middle-class, I guess, socioeconomic family, which eventually we ended up losing quite a bit of income due to some situations that my father encountered. So I guess we were poor, but I never really knew it. I graduated from Woodrow Wilson High School, and I married early, moved. I ended up a victim of domestic violence, which caused me to leave the marriage after I had child, Dante, who is currently 30-some years old, four children, and living in Springfield, Missouri. When I became a single mother, I also ended up on public assistance. I went back to YSU. I went to YSU. I graduated summa cum laude and then decided I would go on to law school. Why law school? This was a very practical reason. People ask me that all the time. You know, why did you pick law? I have to say law probably picked me. When I went to Youngstown State University, I went for creative writing and music. Those were my loves. I had a professor at the time who said, Renee, you're probably a little bit too old to make a living at either of those professions. So you, being a single mom, better think about something else. Well, I figured if I couldn't do what I loved, and I didn't have enough self-confidence really at that time. If anybody knows anything about the cycle of domestic violence, one of the things that completely is robbed of from a person is their sense of self-worth and their confidence. So mine was pretty shaken at that time. And I figured, okay, well, if I can't do that, then let me do something that's going to help at least one person. If I can help one person change their lives for the better, then it will all be worth it. So law just happened to be what came into my mind. In hindsight, I believe that nothing is a coincidence. So I believe that I was led by God to that profession. And so that started my journey into law. I went to Akron Law School, and it was the first year was probably the most amazingly difficult year, one of the most difficult years of my life. I was used to getting straight A's, and here, you know, I'm pulling B's and, you know, a C in one class, and I thought, I just don't have it. I just can't pull this off. But I stuck with it, and I'm so glad I did. I'm so glad I did. So that kind of fast forwards me to where I am now. I've been practicing for, about 23 years. I've, at this point, pretty much done everything. I was a prosecutor. I worked for a trial attorney the entire time, worked for firms, worked independently, was a prosecutor for the city for a while. I was also a mediator for the Common Pleas Court. I've taught at Kent State and Youngstown State University criminal justice courses at YSU, women studies as well. There was a course I taught there. And I also have taught for the Ohio Peace Officers Training Academy. So, yeah, that's kind of...
You think you know a person.
So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's important that we get the opportunity from our own mouth to share who we are, and I wanted to allow you that time to do so. But we'll jump right in. So fast forward to your appointment as the Youngstown Municipal Court Judge. Can you share just briefly a little bit about how that came about?
Well, on top of everything else, I actually am a newlywed. I got married.
Congratulations.
Thank you to the most wonderful man in the world, Michael Raymond.
Yeah.
And we got married a little over a year and a half ago. And I would come home and I would talk about some of the difficulties that my clients would encounter in court, in life. And I had always, constitutional law was my favorite course in law school. And word on the street is, if that's your favorite course, something's definitely wrong with you. But it was. And it was because of the study of what our forefathers really envisioned for each individual, regardless of race, color, sexual orientation, regardless of anything, that we have these innate rights, you know, that's how they saw our system of government. So when I would have these certain clients, and a lot of them were indigent, and I would represent them, I always felt so inadequate. You know, you could only take them so far, because you only had them from a limited period of time, and you could only help them just so much. So I would have these in constitutional law. I thought, what better way to serve people than from the bench? I mean, you have the ability to influence lives. You know, it's really an awesome, and I don't mean awesome great, I mean an awesome, like in a God-fearing kind of way, responsibility, not to be taken lightly.
Sure.
I mean, people look at you when you're on that bench, and you really can change somebody's life. You can make or break somebody by the words of your mouth, and I've seen that happen. I have seen, unfortunately, negative things spoken, and have seen how it has affected people, and I've seen the reverse. I've seen positive and uplifting things from the bench being spoken, and how that changes and helps solidify somebody to continue, encourages them to continue to do the right thing. So I've always wanted to be, but and as crazy as this is going to sound, I'm not a political person.
Interesting.
Right.
I
don't consider myself a political person, but then again, this position is nonpartisan. It's not a political position, even though politics is part of it.
Sure.
Either way, I kind of buried that. I attempted years ago to venture in, and decided perhaps this is not for me. But when I was speaking about being a newlywed, my husband began to tell me, you know, you really should consider doing this. You know, you really need to think about this. Renee, this is something you really need to do. And the opportunity came up when Judge Cobley retired from the bench. And I thought, okay, I don't ever want to say, what if, you know, when I knew that desire was there. So it kind of it stirred up in me, and I decided I would go for the appointment.
And how much was left in that term?
1 year.
1 year.
1 year to the day, actually. November. I took the bench November 5th, and election this year is November 5th.
Yeah.
So it'll be 1 year to the day. So 1 year was left in the term. She had actually retired longer, but the term is, for me, it would have been 1 year. So I decided to apply, And I did, and I, Governor Kasich appointed me. We went through a local vetting committee, which was bipartisan, interracial, and gender mixed. So I went through that committee first. There was, I believe, six of us at the time who applied, and then three were chosen to go down to Governor Kasich's office. The three were interviewed, and then he appointed me to that position.
So I understand you've been endorsed by some different organizations throughout the community. Can
yeah,
you share
actually,
those?
Yeah, actually, it was early on. I obtained the position, and then it was during the Democratic primary. Well, the primary, I was unopposed during the primary, but during the primary, certain union organizations interviewed all candidates at that time, including me, even though I was unopposed. And even before the primary, I was endorsed by two major union organizations, the UAW.
Okay.
And then also the AFL-CIO. I also received the Youngstown Warren Black Caucus endorsement. Now, all three of these, the reason why I mention that is all three of these historically have predominantly gone to Democrats. And early on in this whole process, I received those endorsements. And I think that speaks a lot. That speaks loudly, I think.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So you're thinking back to that time where you didn't believe it was the right moment, and a newlywed comes along, challenges you, and a year left in a term, you find yourself in that seat.
Yes. It's been an amazing 2 years, yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. So one of the reasons I would like to believe that I'm here interviewing you is because you love me.
I do.
But I also believe you know me well enough in my character and integrity that, you know, it is our desire to be fair.
Yes.
And in this moment, we've got to ask some fair questions.
Yes.
So you mentioned earlier about your role being a nonpartisan role, and I don't believe it would be fair to ignore the elephant in the room that maybe some mm-hmm. in the community might question the political affiliation you carry as a Republican.
Right. I am a Republican. I am a Republican. I have not always been a Republican. I was a Democrat and for various reasons I chose that it probably would be more appropriate for me to change to Republican, none of which had anything to do with our sitting president.
Thank you
so,
for that.
You know, I just wanted that those were not the reasons why. That was not part of my thinking, part of my rationale for switching my political affiliation.
Well, we want, you know, I think in speaking for any community in the role of a judge, we want to know that not only is it a nonpartisan position, but that the candidate that occupies that position believes in that same thing, and not only believes in it, but demonstrates it as well. And so,
you mean the nonpartisanship?
Yes.
Absolutely. It has to be. As a role of a judge, I cannot, when somebody's before me, I can't look at their gender. I can't look at their race. I can't look at their religion. You don't want me to. You don't want me to look at your political affiliation. You don't want me to look at your religious beliefs. You want me to look at the facts of the case. You want me to look at you as an individual, independent of everything else, and to weigh the law and justice and fairness. That's what you want me to do. You want me to do that.
As we look at the work that's before you, and we talk about civic engagement in the judicial system, someone out there may not understand the work of the Youngstown Municipal Court. So without getting into specific case details, though, can you share what's coming before you? What are the things that you are seeing that are affecting our communities?
Well, the Youngstown Municipal Court handles misdemeanors. The highest level misdemeanor is a misdemeanor of the first degree, and it's punishable by 6 months and 180 days in jail and up to a $1,000 fine. And so those are the, that's the highest level that we see as far as what we actually deal with daily. The brunt, I will say the majority of the cases that come before our court are driving under suspension and drug cases. And then you have offshoots of those. You have offshoots of maybe theft or solicitation, you know, OVIs, things of that nature. But so those are the brunt of the cases that come before us.
Okay. And so how do you currently address those issues? Are there ways in which you deal with those cases through programming that's in existence or being plan to put into existence? Can you talk a little bit about how we are working through each of those cases?
You know, you really can't address something that question without first looking at some of our current situations. Okay, the city of Youngstown, depending upon what study you look at, is anywhere from I think it was 39 to 40 some percent poverty. Okay, so we have a huge community of indigent and struggling individuals. Let's look at the driving under suspensions. Okay, let's just take that. Here's normally what will happen. If you're looking at, and we have a high rate, let me see, Ohio. Actually, and I brought a couple statistics with me because driving under suspension seems to be my gig. I seem to have fallen into this this kind of keyhole, and happily, I'm happy to be doing that as well. Let me just say that. But Ohio is, I believe, currently ranked second in the country for driving under suspensions. We have like over a million suspended drivers.
Wow.
People driving that are on that are suspended, over a million. Of those million, some of them will have at least three suspensions that they're driving. So we have over a million drivers that are suspended with three or more suspensions. The majority of them having three or four suspensions more. So it is affecting the working poor predominantly is what I'm seeing. So let's say people have to pay their insurance monthly. They just don't have the opportunity to pay it ahead of time. You miss one payment, that insurance company is going to notify the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. You're going to get suspended for driving without insurance, and then you're going to have a reinstatement fee to pay. So let's say you end up getting your insurance, but you don't pay that reinstatement fee. Then you've got a failure to reinstate because you haven't paid the reinstatement fee. And it's a vicious circle. So then you miss another month. You pay that reinstatement fee, but then you miss another month. Okay? Same exact things happen. And if you don't pay that reinstatement fee and then you miss another month and you have another suspension or you go back down, you have another reinstatement fee. The reinstatement fee isn't the same. It escalates. It's enhanceable. So you're paying more. And so people are getting trapped in this. Every time you get one, if you haven't paid that reinstatement fee, let's say the first reinstatement fee is $45. You don't pay it. You get picked up again. You have another reinstatement fee. That next reinstatement fee is like, let's say, 140. It more than doubles. So let's say it's $145. So now you owe $145. You get a third one, it goes up again. So it's not like the other two get thrown away and you just have this higher number. No, it keeps increasing in fees and they add those together. So you can see how people can really get stuck in this revolving door of the reinstatement fees, driving under suspensions, because there's all kinds of suspensions. Yeah. You know, we can't even begin to measure those.
So, and as you mentioned, you know, the rate of poverty in a community like Youngstown, access to transportation,
right.
That prevents us from access to quality jobs. this becomes a nasty circle of life
for
a community that's already experienced such trauma.
Yes.
And so how are the courts becoming more approachable as it seeks to deal with what you've mentioned as becoming sort of a commonality that you're seeing coming before you?
Yeah, well, my court had already established, when I took the bench, a SLIP program, a suspended license intervention program. And okay. What that did was you would plead into that. You would say, you know, I'm guilty, I'm going to come into this SLIP court, and then it gave you 4 months to become valid. And then if you got valid, everything got dismissed, so nothing went down to the BMV, you didn't have points, you know, it is a great program. When I took the bench, there were only two people in that program because the requirements and the way that you could qualify to get into the program was so narrow that we really weren't getting a lot of people to come in. So I kind of broadened that. When I took the bench, I broadened it. We grew it in 2 months from two participants to 32.
Wow.
So that helps. And then
Are you seeing the apprehension come down? Because I don't know if people who find themselves in this position are running to the courts.
Well, no, let me tell you. If you don't, you could have a driving under suspension. You could be suspended and not have a traffic case open in the Youngstown Municipal Court. Okay, because you haven't gotten picked up yet. The BMV can suspend your license themselves. It's an administrative agency. Okay. So they have their own guidelines. So if they get a notice, let's say they get a notice. I don't get a notice. The court doesn't get a notice that you haven't paid your insurance. They send that down to the BMV. The BMV administratively suspends your license. So you go through a stop sign and the police run your license. They see, oh my gosh, not only did he run the stop sign, but he's driving on a suspended license. And I will tell you, some people don't even know that they're suspended when they're picked up.
Wow.
Because even though the BMV has to send a notice, sometimes people have moved and they're not thinking to notify the BMV that they moved. So the notice went out, but it went somewhere different.
It never got
to them. So until they get a traffic ticket, until they get picked up by the police for whatever other reason, and you know, they're not before me. This is what we did to solve that situation. So it's not like they're running to the court. There's nothing for them to run to because there's not an open case for them.
Sure.
Now, there were Professor Dowling out of, and I believe he was from Akron, along with Judge McKinney, developed this program they call the Valid Clinic. Our name for it here is the SLIP program.
Okay.
It's not the SLIP court. That's the one that's in my court.
Sure.
But the SLIP program, this is our outreach. And it is the Valid Clinic. It's run exactly the same way that these gentlemen devise. We work with legal aid, and we work with local attorneys and other organizations. And it's an entire full course clinic open to the public. We did this. We've had two so far that have been absolutely successful. Amazing. Over 200 people each time we've done it have come through to try for assistance to get valid. We ran it last time, it was in conjunction with the amnesty program. The BMV had an amnesty program, which they're going to have again beginning October 17th, in which you come in, you see whether or not you qualify to get some or all of your reinstatement fees forgiven. It's an amazing thing that the state is doing. It has helped more people become valid, to find employment, to not be looking over their shoulders when they have to take their children to the doctors or to school or to go grocery shopping. It's been an amazing program. Well, that ended in June. They have decided to give us another 6 months of that. So beginning October 17th, we're having another 6 months of that. We are on October 26th having another SLIP outreach, another SLIP program. And what people will do, whoever is not involved in the court system, even if you are involved in the court system, you have open cases or whatever, you can come in and you're going to talk to someone from the BMV, you're going to talk to a lawyer, you're going to be able to see exactly what do you need to do to become valid. A lot of people can't become valid because there are warrant blocks. Maybe they have unpaid fines and court costs, and so there's a block that has been placed on their license so that they can't get valid. They can't get They can't drive no matter what they do. They've got to get that lifted. If you come to this valid clinic, I've been working with local judges in the county, the misdemeanor courts, and almost every one of them, including our county courts, Judge J.P. Morgan is kind of like our point person for our county courts. That's Boardman, Sebring, Canfield, Austin Town, the county courts, the misdemeanor county courts. If you come to our program, you'll end up getting a certificate. You take that certificate to the court. You enter into a payment program for your warrant blocks and any other fees, court costs, fines. You enter into this payment program. The warrant block is lifted. You can get a valid license. And as long as you keep those payments up, and we try to keep them pretty reasonable, as long as you keep those payments up, you can drive validly. There's not going to be another block on your license. So that helps, but you have to come to the clinic to do it.
Yeah.
Now, at the clinic, we're also going to have people there from child support. So if you have a child support suspension, you can get on a payment plan or talk to someone with that. We're going to have MICAP there. MICAP has funds available for indigent people that qualify to help them pay some of these costs that might be associated. It doesn't even have to be just with driving. They're there to help you.
Where are these clinics held at? Is it typically?
This one is going to be held at the First Presbyterian Church, 201 Wick Avenue.
So in the community.
Yes, definitely.
The outreach you speak of, we're definitely going out into the community to do it.
Yep, we are going. That's it. We're being proactive. So we're trying to get you before you have to come see me.
So often we see these moments as someone's out to get you or malicious, when the outreach you speak of is we're trying to head this off.
That's exactly what we're trying to do.
I think from what you've described, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you see how this challenge for our community and access to transportation and a valid driver's license plays into our overall challenge of poverty that's
inflicting
itself on our community. So
We had one lady, just a real quick story, with our last clinic that we had, I think it was back in June, she came in and she had over $7,000 in reinstatement fees forgiven. It enabled her to get a license. She was in tears and she told me, she said, I can go. But she was having to work two jobs because she had to take a bus to these jobs. So she was having to work two jobs, making minimum wage, and she still wasn't able to make it. And then I ran into her and she said she is now working one job because she's able to drive. She got better employment. She's able to be home at night with her children. So even if all of that was for that one person, it just is worth it.
And the residual of that.
Absolutely.
Because now she gets to be
and the quality of
home.
Life for her children. Sure. I mean, really, it all plays into it. The driving under suspension predominantly affects the working poor the hardest.
Yeah. And we're taking our time with this for a specific reason. I know that much of our conversation has been on this, but I think as we sit and talk about it now, we recognize how important and how deeply embedded it is into the livelihoods of those that are challenged in this community to pull themselves up. I think that there are people who, as you state, they don't want a hand out, but we have ways in which we can lift them up.
Yeah.
And we don't sort of maybe frame that around transportation. We've attempted to answer that question on job applications for years and decades of, do you have access to reliable transportation? And we understand that a community that's almost 40% in poverty may not be able to answer that question confidently or with a yes, or even truthfully, just to try and get the job.
And that's true. There's a couple other things I want to talk real quickly about. One of the things that we have implemented as well is a victims of human trafficking court. We call it Grace Court.
Yeah.
And it's growth restored through acceptance, change, and empowerment. And we are now waiting. We have submitted all the paperwork to the Ohio Supreme Court to make it a specialized docket. In Ohio, Ohio is rated fourth in the country for human trafficking. We see two forms of human trafficking. We see labor and we see sex. So we have labor human trafficking, and then we have sexual human trafficking, okay? Human trafficking for sex.
And would you believe that, you know, specifically Youngstown and even Ohio, that that people would agree that that's happening right in our own neighborhood?
Well, I think it's difficult for people to understand how we see it locally. You know, when you talk about human trafficking, you're thinking about, you know, what was that one? I don't remember the one movie where, you know, someone's actually a runaway is maybe snatched in New York and taken away. That's not
We imagine, you know, truckloads of people.
Or immigrants, right. Truckloads of immigrants being dropped off. And that's really not what we see here locally. What we have here locally, well, Ohio has 25% labor trafficking. Okay, you're going to see this sometimes in, like, predominantly you see it in spas, nail salons, hair places. Some of these women are being trafficked for labor. They come from other countries, and sometimes their passports are taken, driver's license are taken. They don't know the language, so they're stuck. And so we see some of that. But 75% of Ohio is sex trafficking, and there is a intersectionality with drug abuse and the human trafficking. Some of them are being trafficked because they are so strung out on their drugs, and this is the only way that they can pay their dealer. Some of them have been fed by their dealers these drugs to keep them dependent. They cut off all of their resources. So food, shelter, clothing, the drug dealer supplies to them. Wow. And then what happens is the drug dealer uses them as an income source. So they're just another income source. The local human trafficking task force, which I work with, the Mahoney County task force and the state task force, told me that a drug dealer can make upwards of $60,000 on one woman a year.
$60,000.
So if we take care of this human trafficking, not only are we taking care of this person and helping that person become independent, but we're taking away an income source from the drug dealer.
Yeah.
We have to dry that up. We've got to dry those things up.
And you know, so you talked about forgiveness as it pertained to, you know, fees when it came to an issue with someone's driver's license. But I believe that in your grace program, we're talking about a moment where someone needs forgiveness in a whole different way that, as you stated, has found themselves maybe in a position where you know, a drug abuse has led them to be isolated and used by someone, but still appears before your court in actual legal trouble.
That's been the majority, although that's not all of it. Some of them have a history of domestic violence in their and sexual abuse in their family, and so it has led them to that type of lifestyle. But yeah, I mean, I have a hard time believing that some young woman, and I say men are also victims, but in our area the majority of what we see is women.
Okay.
And I really have a hard time believing that a young lady at the age of 11 or 12 wakes up one day and says, when I grow up, I'm going to be a prostitute. Strung out on drugs. You know, that's not a goal. It happens, and it happens for a number of reasons. And again, there is an intersectionality between this poverty that we are seeing, drug abuse, sexual trafficking. They intersect.
So speak to, because you spoke earlier when we talked about your personal life about, you know, divorce and coming under some of your own domestic violence, suffering that. How has that informed your perspective from the bench and how you're dealing with those that are coming before you for, you know, human trafficking, but have suffered some of that same abuse as well?
It's a cycle. You know, I was very fortunate. You know, I had the resources available to me to learn about what I was in, that cycle of abuse that I was in. So I was fortunate because before I divorced, I began my YSU venture the year before I divorced. And I was in a psychology class, and that class dealt, a portion of it dealt with domestic violence and the cycle of domestic violence, and it helped me realize what I was in. So that actually, it does, it transforms onto the bench, so that when these women are coming before me, I can see, you know, you're still stuck in the cycle, you're stuck there, you know, there's ebbs and flows, and there's a whole psychology behind. I'm not a psychologist, but when they come before me, I can understand and I can give them tools to help them. I can tell them, okay, you're on probation, I'm gonna put you on probation, but I'm going to require you to get this type of treatment and this assessment, things that can help them hopefully come to the realization themselves, give them the strength and the courage to move beyond where they are.
So what's interesting is the perceptions that many probably carry about the courts in general, in that if you find yourself before a judge, it's the feeling of a gavel coming down upon you in a sentencing. The courts you're describing seem to be completely different, completely unorthodox in its solutions to the challenges that we have in our community. It sounds like you're describing a court with a heart. Does that make sense?
Well,
and I'm generalizing because not everyone within the courts.
Right.
And
I think in general, that seems to be where the judiciary of the state is moving now. I think we have seen, and the Supreme Court is also encouraging treatment courts. We see that incarceration doesn't work. And not only that, but incarceration it not only does not work because it's not rehabilitative. So we're seeing repeat offenders. We're seeing they call that recidivism. You're going to continue to enter into the criminal justice system.
That nasty cycle we keep talking about
Right.
Poverty.
Now, wouldn't it be better if we use the money that we're using to house criminals to use it towards treatment? We'd probably be saving money. And I did a little bit of research, and if you look, some of the stats are that you're paying anywhere between $67 to $80 a day to house someone institutional, you know, in a jail or in a prison, $67 to $80. So let's be conservative. Let's say $70 a day. All right. In 1 year, that's $25,500 per person.
Which is slightly above the median income of this.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so that's one person. That's a year. Now, let's just go daily. Currently, and I looked it up this morning, we have a little over, I think we have like 508 people housed in our jail right now.
Wow.
Okay, so 500, that's costing us $35,000 a day to house those individuals in our jail. Now, that's without treatment. They're not getting education. They're not, okay, they might be taking a couple courses, but it's just housing those people. We have to do something different. The Supreme Court recognizes that. The legislature recognizes that. They're telling us to start looking at some of these crimes a little bit differently. All right. So we want to do that. We need to kind of change our response to certain crimes.
Sure.
Some of them, listen, there are people who simply have to be incarcerated, and that's the bottom line. They're not going to change. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So they need to be incarcerated, but there are others who need a little direction. They need help. You know, one of the other things that I'm going to start, Governor DeWine just released some money. In 2020, he has released some money for treatment courts for mental health. We are sorely lacking mental health facilities and treatment.
Yeah.
We need a treatment court in the misdemeanor court. We have one in common pleas. We definitely need one in the mental health court. That's one of the other things that I'm going to be working on, hopefully after this election cycle. That's some of the things that we're seeing. So we have to start changing our response to some of these crimes. So yes, we are moving more towards treatment courts because they work. We see drug court. Judge Carla Baldwin starting a drug court. She has a very successful veterans court. She's also waiting for her Supreme Court certification for her drug court. The municipal court right now is really focused on more of a holistic approach to the criminal justice problem and situation. You cannot just look at incarceration. That's not helping us. if we start changing our responses to certain crimes and we start looking at things, we're going to have a safer community. We're going to have a more productive community. We're going to be saving money because we're not using the jail for incarcerating people that don't need to be in there. We're changing lives. We're adding to the whole success rate of the city of Youngstown. The quality of life will improve. It can't help but help.
Yeah.
The city.
Wonderful.
You know, we talked a lot about this generational poverty, and I don't mean to kind of usurp you, but I did want to talk about one other thing. Judge Carol Robb's a good friend of mine. She is currently on the Court of Appeals, our 7th District Court of Appeals. She had a program down in Columbiana when she was a municipal court judge. It was called the Getting Ahead Program.
Okay.
It was based out of the Bridges Out of Poverty model. Okay, I don't know if anybody's, if you're familiar with it, put myself through training along with my some of my staff. And what this model does is it will, this Getting Ahead program, it's kind of like a treatment court, sort of. What they'll do is they will plead in if they're identified as someone who the root cause of their crime is generational poverty, not situational poverty, generational poverty. If they can be identified as suffering from generational poverty, then we can get them into this program. This program, if someone is suffering from generational poverty, they don't have the luxury of planning their life.
Sure.
Their luxury is, how do I get through today? That's the furthest they can do. How can I meet my needs today? Some of us can't even identify with that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean,
I come from what's known as in my community as the black tax, and we understand that those are things you've inherited from your parents. Where you step out of your home and your credit's already ruined. Your parents have placed upon you burdens before you even get out of the home. So when you speak about generational, there are people who understand exactly what that means.
Yes. And there's a mindset that goes with that. It's a survival mindset. What do I need to do to get through today to get these needs met? And that's how they live. So this program helps these people identify where they are, to actually help them see what are some of the resources that they have available to them that maybe they don't know about. It gives them wraparound services. Do they need drug rehabilitation? Do they need mental health? Do they need housing? There are some agencies that we'll be utilizing as well to wrap around and help them. You know, we've got a lot of blight in this area. Most of that is because of the poverty level, okay? There's not much that can be done. Agencies now, we have agencies that are getting grant money that are able to help these people rehabilitate their homes. We're seeing the ability of these agencies to come in and assist people with the painting and roofs and things like that. The criminal justice system isn't the place for people who cannot take care of their homes because either they're suffering from mental illness or generational poverty. But thank God we have these agencies around. So we have wraparound services that would help people that come into my court, that will come into our court system, that are suffering from generational poverty. We wrap around services, educational. You know, are these people that are able to go to college, or maybe their trade school is a better fit? We get them and we wrap services around them to help begin to bridge the gap between where they are and where their destiny, where their potential actually is. So we help bridge that gap. Now on the back end, we work with employers and we educate the employers to what individuals suffering from generational poverty are going through, what their mindsets are, what their expectations are. Oftentimes, there is no agreement of the minds. They are, the employers are thinking one way. The people, the employees who maybe are suffering from generational poverty, but they're the working poor, are thinking a different way. I'll give you an example. I heard a story. A woman with 4 children, she had the only car in not only her family, but in the neighborhood. So she was a resource to everybody else. Her car breaks. Now she can't make it to work. She's making minimum wage at a store. Now this was not locally, but in the training they told us this story. So she could not make it to work. on time because she had to rely on other people or the bus. She gets to work late. Now, the boss doesn't know that. Her supervisor doesn't know that. All he knows is that for 1 week, she's been coming in late. She's supposed to be there 8 to 5. She's not coming until 9:30. What does he do? By Friday, he comes, brings her in, reprimands her. What does she do? She quits. I don't need this. I'm only working minimum wage. I'm not making my ends meet. I don't need this hassle. He has no idea how I am struggling to get my 4 children to school in the morning and then find a way here to work. He has no idea. So what does she do? She walks out. Costs that guy $60,000 every time someone gets fired or walks out of his place of employment. So what happens is you educate the employer. What are the needs of your employees? How can we bridge that gap? Judge Rob implemented, and I'm really kind of short-circuiting this whole thing, but with that balance of communication and understanding, there was this one employer received the training for this, and he so bought into the program that he went out and bought a bus. Wow. Hired someone to go and drive and pick up his employees and drop them back off. His productivity increased, the lives and the quality of his employees increased, and it was a wonderful thing. Well, Judge Rob implemented this program in her municipal court, and she told me of the ones who entered into the program, she had 80% less recidivism. 80% of them never came back into the criminal justice system.
Wow.
It can change our area.
Yeah.
And that is probably another program I'm really looking forward to implementing and working on.
You're just blowing my mind.
I know.
Now, I want to ask, because we've talked about a lot. We've talked about the courts recognizing more of a holistic approach. We've talked about generational poverty, the generational mentalities that are creating these vicious cycles. We've talked about the things that you're doing, that you bring in from your background and your experiences. We've talked about some of the programming with SLIP, dealing with, you know, suspended license. We've talked about human trafficking and sex trafficking through the GRACE program that you've implemented. After hearing all of those things, for anyone listening, what would you say to someone who would still question your love or your loyalty for this specific community and why you should be retained as a Youngstown Municipal Court judge?
Well, and I understand that there will be those who will question my love or my ability, my commitment, and that's okay. They can do that. But take a look at what we've accomplished. Take a look at where the court is going, where it was, where it is now. Talk to people. Talk to those who are coming in. Talk to people who are being helped by these programs. When you see those results, when you can hear the voices and the changed lives that are happening, you can't question. You can't question the results, right?
It's like what do they say,
the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah.
So you talk to some of the people who have come into the courtroom, talk to some of the people who have benefited from these programs. And I'm asking you to keep me there because there's more that we can do together. We can accomplish a lot. We can change this city. We can make it what it used to be, what it is meant to be. There's great people who live here. And there's many people who are in our system that don't need to be in our system. They just need help. And I'm not demeaning at all the seriousness of any crimes, because we do know that those exist and there are people who need to be punished for those. But there's a lot of people who are just stuck and they need to be helped and assisted to move out of that place.
Awesome. So in talking about everything that we've talked about so far, in hearing all the wonderful things that have been done in the courts and that are planned, I want to take it a little bit outside of the courts now and talk about how do you maintain public trust in you in the work that you're doing throughout the community.
I have a life of service to the community. I have always been involved in community organizations, Easter Seals, my church affiliation. My church is very involved in the community. I currently am The executive director for the Meet Me at the Cross organization, which is a 501c3 that is seeking unity amongst the community, you know, bridging racial divides, religious divides. It's a wonderful organization. I also am on the board of the Bear Foundation. This is a foster home, Christian foster home organization that finds foster homes and adoptions for some of the most at-risk children. So I'm very involved in that organization as well. As a judge, it is real important for us to be out in the community. We want, and I think that's probably something that we're seeing more of now. I know that I serve, as I said, with Judge Baldwin, and she's very involved in the community and outreaches yes. and getting out there, and I am as well. And that helps bridge a lot of fear. It makes us more accessible, makes the courts more accessible. And we can also find out a lot of information from the community by talking to individuals. What are some of the needs that we're seeing? You know, I've been asked to speak at different symposiums. We've got a human traffic symposium coming up on October 25th, I believe, and I'm speaking again for the domestic violence ceremony that they're going to be having coming up here. When we can do these outreaches, when we're involved in these different organizations, we can bring a part of that back to the bench. More understanding, more insight, understanding more needs and how we can help the individuals that come before us.
And what I was hoping you would dispel is the myth that judges don't pump their own gas.
Oh, I definitely pump my own gas and I wash my own car. Although my husband would question exactly how often I do wash that car. But yes, definitely I do.
But it is. I mean, it's important for us to know that judges are human, that we do see them out in our communities. And again, that it's not just the drop of a gavel when we see you, but that we see you engaged in the moments that are important to the communities that you want to serve and are serving in.
I have the honor of personally knowing a lot of those who serve on the bench in Common Pleas and the Court of Appeals, and I know that each and every one of those judges has a heart to serve, and that's what it takes. It takes compassion, it takes commitment, and it takes experience to do this job.
So we see locally, regionally, even nationally, efforts to really pay attention to positions that have great impact on communities. There are efforts to focus in on district attorneys across the country, or we know how important the Senate is in areas of our government. When it comes to judge, I'm not sure that our communities focus in on how their vote in choosing who will govern their community from our Youngstown Municipal Court, how imperative that vote is. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
Oh, sure. The municipal court is probably the court that most people, if they do come in contact with the court, it's probably going to be the municipal court because of the level of charges that we have. Someone in your family, if not you, someone in your family will likely at some point get a traffic ticket, or they're going to get maybe a driving under suspension, possibly. You know, somehow there will be an interaction with that court. It is vital that you have the right person on that bench. You want to have a person who is going to fairly and fully look at that individual in an unbiased way, look at that case, and determine it in accordance with the law and with justice, and to serve justice for all equally. Your vote counts. Each and every vote counts. I heard of a story of a gentleman who won an election by one vote, and this man set forth to change his community. Every vote counts. We have to be involved. You can't sit there and complain about what's going on in the city and then not become involved enough or not care enough to get out there and vote. And I would hope that you would vote for me. Now, early voting starts October 8th, and then the general election is November 5th. So between now and then, take a look. You can look at the website. You can look at my Facebook page. If you have questions, you can contact us, and I'm happy to answer it. But your vote matters. Your vote counts.
Wow. After all of that, I am so encouraged by you. And again, I just want to thank you. Thank you for joining me here today, Judge DeSalvo. I thank you for your transparency and your honesty. I thank you for what the courts and you are doing in this community that I so love and I know that you love as well. And so thank you for the honor and pleasure of being able to sit and talk with you.
And thank you, Derek, for spending this time with me. And I want to thank all those who are listening for taking the time to listen and for hearing the heart of this little girl from the south side of Youngstown. I hope that you do vote on October 8th through November 5th to retain Judge Renee DeSalvo, Youngstown Municipal Court. Thank you.